The search for the historical Moses is a relatively modern enterprise. Older generations were satisfied to take the story of Moses existentially in its totality. They were not so concerned as we are to discover that which actually happened and was therefore authentic. For the test of authenticity was the value, the meaning, the ideas, the imagery which transmitted itself through the biography and through the story. And so they knew just as well as we do that if a piece of wood burns, it is reduced ultimately to ash. There is no such thing as a bush which burns continually and does not fall apart. And yet they understood that on the level of imagery, the story of the burning bush bespeaks a God who is an unlimited source of enlightenment, a God who is beyond boundaries, beyond circumscription. And they were prepared to accept that story simply on those terms. They knew Moses as the unparalleled and unique founder of our faith. They accepted the brief eulogy with which the Bible buries Moses. V'lo kam b'Yisrael k'navi od asher yida'o Adonai panim el panim. There did not arise in Israel another prophet like unto Moses, whom the Lord had known face to face. In the Middle Ages, the great philosopher Maimonides spoke of Moses as unparalleled. It was he who pierced every veil. It was he who understood the ultimate secrets of divinity, of humanity, secrets which before and since have been hidden from more ordinary men. But ours is an historical age and a secular age, and we like to know what we call the facts. So let's this morning concentrate on the search for the historical Moses. What manner of man was he, this founder of our people? What was his look? What was his history? What was his purpose in being? And when we do search for the historical Moses, we find that about three generations ago, men who were the inaugurators, the first to understand the critical approach to the Bible, questioned the very existence of Moses himself. They had discovered through their research that the Bible was not written, for the most part, contemporaneous with the events it describes. The Exodus took place in the 13th, perhaps in the 14th pre-Christian century. The earliest written editions of the Torah were set down in the 10th and the 9th century, 300-400 years after the events. And these men, arguing from the way in which we operate in modern times, said that if you start a story and it's told by word of mouth from generation to generation, the story becomes so distorted over the period of time that it is unlike anything which occurred originally. And so they said, Moses was in all probability not a man, but the name of a tribe, a name of a tribe of slaves who somehow escaped from Egyptian bondage, and all of the stories told about Moses are simply later reworkings, embroidery, the adding of personality to a simple, otherwise anonymous historical fact. But as we pursued the critical study of the Bible further, we discovered some interesting things. The first was this, that the ancients did not transmit their oral history in the same way that we do, that you cannot equate rumor and the ancient traditions. Lacking literacy, having no written record, the ancient tribes had poets and priests, clans of people who were responsible for memorizing the traditions of the clan and handing them down from generation to generation so that they may be appropriately recited at the festivals and the commemorative days of the tribe. And so it is that when we began to know more about the age of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, about the 20th, the 19th, the 18th pre-Christian century, we discover that the details of events as they are told in Genesis are surprisingly accurate and apposite, that they in fact could have occurred only in that period of time, only in the way in which the Bible describes them. And similarly of the story of Moses. The story is set in an Egyptian milieu, and the names and the setting, the background, is uniquely Egyptian of the 13th, 14th pre-Christian century. The very name Moses, though the Bible gives it a Hebrew etymology, is in fact an Egyptian name. It means the son of. The Pharaoh Tutmoshe, Tutmoses, means the son of the god Tut. Moshe is a common Egyptian name. And so it was with Phineas and with many other names of the time. And so we know now that we need not discount the accuracy of the biblical narrative simply because it was not set down at the very time that it claims to record. And as we pressed our investigation further, we found something interesting. The normal history of a legend is this, that General Custer fights a battle with Sitting Bull, and that subsequent generations take Custer's last stand, and they embellish it, and they embroider it, and they distort it, and they add to it. But as we became more and more skillful in separating out the various strands of the biblical narrative, we discovered that, interestingly, the further we got from the events themselves, the more recent the editing, the less is told of Moses. There seems to be a deliberate attempt to diminish, to restrict the biography of Moses. And in fact, we can explain why and how. For we know that the Bible is written not as secular history, but as sacred history. It is the history of God's acts within the terms of human existence. And the biblical narrators wanted to emphasize that God was a deliverer. Moses was only his agent. God was the lawgiver. Moses was only the scribe. And so as they got further and further away from the events, later editions of the Bible diminish, constrict the force of Moses' personality. And in fact, they would have done away with it entirely if it had not been so dominant, so vigorous, so alive. So you get in the mission in post-biblical times, interestingly enough, a whole series of interpretations which are intended to take the various sentences in the Bible which describe great power to Moses and denying that power to Moses. The Bible, for instance, says in the book of Exodus, during a particular battle with the Amalekites, when Moses held up his hands high, the Israelites prevailed, and when his hands became weary and slack and fell to his side, the Amalekites prevailed. And the editors of the Mishnah in the first, second century of the Common Era asked the question, did in fact the hands of Moses have the power to control the destiny of the battle? And they answered, of course not. This whole sentence is to be taken symbolically. When Israel raises its hands to God in prayer and in piety, God will allow them to prevail. When they become slack in their devotion, the Israelites will fall and be destroyed. And the most interesting example of this diminution of the role of Moses exists in the Haggadah, our Passover prayer book, where they actually succeed in retelling the story of the Exodus and of Sinai without once mentioning the name of Moses. Moses is completely erased. He no longer exists. God is the actor. God controls the destinies of men. And Moses now has been reduced beyond the role of agent and scribe. He's simply been eliminated. And so we know now that our fathers would never have invented Moses and given him a personality, that in fact he was a stumbling block to the sacred history which they wished to write. There was a Moses, but to say that is not to be able to describe him, to give him flesh and blood. What manner of man was he? Let me try and reconstruct Moses for you against the background of the history of the day. In the 18th pre-Christian century, a group of hill peoples, aliens from Anatolia and Turkey, conquered Egypt. They were known as the Hyksos, which is an Egyptian word for stranger, foreigner. And they ruled Egypt for 2.5 centuries. They were a small military band, a feudal class. They ruled the masses of the Egyptians, and they ruled by bringing in from the Semitic countries round about all manner of bright young men who could staff their offices and do the accounting work and the governing work for them. This was a period in which a young Joseph could have come to high office in the bureaucracy of Egypt. And then around the year 1550, there was a nativist Egyptian revolt against the Hyksos, and they were driven out and destroyed by the 19th Egyptian dynasty. And all the people who had acted as their servants and as their agents were either destroyed, killed, or enslaved. These must have been the pharaohs who arose who knew not Joseph. And all of these Semitic tribes who had once been in power in Egypt were now reduced to bondage, and they were put to the building of the great pyramids and of the great store cities and citadels and ceremonial centers of the Egyptians. And in this nativist dynasty, there was a rather mad man, a man named Ramses II, who believed in building monuments to himself all over the countryside, and he in fact took the old Hyksos capital at Avaris, which is in Goshen, where Joseph and the tribes did live, according to our Bible, and he rebuilt it as a great center, and he renamed it after himself, and the Bible tells us that the children of Israel were put to building the great store cities of Pitom and Ramses. Now, how long were the Jews in bondage? How many generations sweated and bled and suffered in slavery? We have no way of knowing. Nor have we any reason to believe that the early story told us of Moses is in fact true. To understand what can be known of the historical Moses, we need certain critical tools. And the first of these tools is some knowledge of the comparative mythology and the legendary histories told of all the great heroes of antiquity. And one thing is clear, that of each of the great kings, of each of the great leaders, his people ascribed to him nobility of birth. All manner of miraculous things occurred about his coming on earth. And this is as true of Moses in his day as of Jesus in his. Now Moses, we are told, is born at a time when there was an edict that every Hebrew male child is to be put to death. To save him, his mother builds this cradle of bulrushes and coats it with pitch and puts it into the Nile. It's a wonderful story. Our children in the religious school love to color the cradle and put in the boy Moses. But 1,200 years before, a poet who was glorifying the great king of Sumer, Sargon, told the very same story of this great king. He was born. At that time, there was an edict against his particular community. His mother, to save him, put him in a cradle of bulrushes and put him not in the Nile, but in the Tigris, in the great river god, and he sailed on to immortality. So these stories about the early youth of Moses must be set aside as embroidery and as legend. We must also set aside all that is patently anachronistic in the story of Moses. The legends, the laws of Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers are full of rather minute prescriptions having to do with the temple, the priest cult, the sacrifices, what sacrifices to be offered on what occasion and for what purpose. And we know that during the wilderness wanderings, there was no temple, and the Jews did not offer sacrifices, and they had no priest class. These are all later additions, later laws which were predated to Mosaic times in order to give them greater sanctity. These are some of the ways in which we scalpel down the present story of Moses as it appears to us to get to the historical kernel. But what can we say then? Somehow, in the 13th, 14th pre-Christian century, a young Hebrew slave escaped from the slave pens. Now, he didn't get into the palace of the Pharaoh, but he went and he fled into the wilderness, just across the bayous of bulrush, the swamps which separate Egypt from Sinai. And there he joined with one of the wilderness tribes, the Midianites, a group of smiths and of shepherds. And he married, he settled down, and he had two sons, and he led a rather idyllic life. He was well cared for and well provided for. He was a free man. He lived among one of the more literate of the tribes, one of the more skillful of the tribes in the wilderness. But there was something in the soul of this man which gave him no rest. He had escaped from Egypt. He had escaped from the slave pens. But his family, his friends, his clans, all still sweated and were beaten and suffered. And he felt, I ought to do something for them. But what could one small, insignificant shepherd in the Midianite wilderness do for a people who were enslaved? The problem, however, bothered him. And in his day, in that world, they didn't speak of the unconscious. When a man wrestled with himself and suddenly came to an understanding of duty, God had spoken to him. The clarity, what we call insight, was revelation. And the Bible gives us a rather clear picture of a man struggling with himself in the environment of God. He tells God, why should I go? Who shall I say send me? What chance have I of success? But there's a strong flow of strength. God tells him, you must go. And finally, there's this moment of enlightenment, and he says, Hineni, here am I, send me. So this man leaves and puts behind him security and safety, and he goes back without much hope, without any power, save the sense that God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of the tribes, has sent him. He goes back to free his people. And of course, the people haven't the courage to dare even to think of freedom. They rebuff Moses and they tell him, why have you come? If we dare to strike out for freedom, we will be pursued and we will be destroyed. Things are bad enough as they are. Let's leave them. At least we can survive. Don't make them worse. But such is the strength, the charisma of Moses' personality. Such is the power of this man, that he can somehow overcome the inertia, the fear of this enslaved people. And he makes them feel that the God who had sent him, their God, the God of their ancestors, will bring them up out of Egypt. Now, how did he do it? We have no way of knowing. Perhaps there was some external attack on Egypt at the time which caused them to conscript most of the sheriffs who kept the labor gangs in check, and there was a chance to break out. Perhaps some great natural disaster overcame Egypt, a plague of locusts or the bubonic plague or something of this kind. We have no way of knowing. All that we do know is that events worked out in such a way that a group of slaves, not only Hebrew, a group of slaves, a motley, the Bible calls them, an asafsuf, were able to escape and somehow made good their escape. And Moses, by the force of his personality, convinced them that this had not been an accident. They had not escaped by chance, but rather this had been the will of God. He had made the conditions which had made the escape possible. And he bound the people to their God. And such was Moses' personality, for he was a great, powerful leader, determined, and yet a great mystic, profoundly spiritual and religious man, that he somehow understood that simply bringing the tribes out of Egypt was not enough. He had to bring them into freedom and then to make them understand that there is real freedom only when you accept a basic law. And now we have the symbol of Sinai. We do not know where Sinai was or if in fact there was a Sinai. But we do know that somehow in this wilderness period, Moses bound the people to a new law, to a basic discipline, the commandments, and that he engraved these laws upon stone, and that these stones were carried in a portable ark before the people as a symbol of their basic law. The covenant was again and again and again reaffirmed in Hebrew history. This was the first. Its contents, its specifics are not clear to us. Some scholars doubt that they are the exact equivalent of the Ten Commandments as we know them. Perhaps so, perhaps not. But it is clear that Moses bound the people to God. And this itself is of interest. Because this people, our ancestors, were not a devoted people. And they were not a pious people. And they were not an easy people to lead. They rebuffed Moses when he came to Egypt. No sooner had they crossed out of Egypt and were free, no sooner had they sung the great hymn of deliverance, Ashira Ladonai ki ga'o ga'a susferach va rama bayam, I will sing unto the Lord, for he has done mightily, horse and rider as he cast into the sea. No sooner did they know that they were free than they rebelled against Moses and said, why hast thou brought us into this land where there is so little food and so little to drink? At least in Egypt we had the flesh pots for all of the whip of the taskmaster. We had food to fill our bellies. Again and again men rose in rebellion and revolt and complaint against Moses. And he had to deal with them sternly and strictly, and ultimately he gave up on that generation and realized that a generation would have to pass and a new generation be born, who had not known the contagion, the debilitating psychology of having been slaves. Only a very strong, a very dynamic man could have managed to lead this people without being broken by them. They were stiff-necked and ornery and worse. Now the thing that interests me about Moses, this great founding father of ours, is that despite the unbelievable accomplishment which is his, despite the demands made upon his personality, despite the fact that he had to be from an autocratic leader, he had to impose his will upon the community, he never separated his well-being from theirs. When ancient leaders rose to power, the first thing they did was to establish a dynasty, to see that that power would be handed down to their children and to their grandchildren. Of Moses' children, we know only their names. There's not a single indication in Scripture that Moses sought at any time to pass power, authority, royalty down to them. He was concerned with the escape of the people, their well-being, not with feathering his own nest, establishing the importance of his family. And I read to you this morning the story, as the Bible tells us, of the making of the golden calf. It's a fascinating story because of what it tells us the ancients understood to be the personality of Moses. God is sick to heart. God wants to destroy the children who have rebelled against him and known so little of loyalty that the moment Moses is gone for a day more than they expected, they build for themselves this idol. And God says to Moses, what? I'm going to destroy this people. And I'm going to build from thee, from thy seed, a new nation. And this nation will inherit the earth. He promises Moses everything for himself and his family. And what does Moses say? He argues with God. If thou wilt forgive this people, well and good. If not, blot me out too from thy book. He never separates his destiny from the great sense of purpose, service to his people, which is the reason for his being. There's an amazing lack of egotism in the leadership of Moses. You see it in his death. Ancients died, great ancient men, leaders, and they raised the great pyramids and they raised great tombs. And they talked of them as saints, and people came to their graves and lit lights and offered prayers of intercession. But not so with Moses. He died. The Bible tells us, "V'lo ish yadat kavurato ad hayom hazeh," that no man knows his grave unto this day. He dies, and the sum of his biography is written in his achievements, but the Bible also says he dies short of the promised land. He dies without complaint, this great leader of ours. He has served his people. He's taken them as far as he can take them. Now is the time for another leader to arise. He does not ask that he be enshrined, that there be an apotheosis prescribed for him, to become a saint, to be beatified. He is satisfied to have lived, and his last great prayer for his people is, let Reuben live and not die. Let Israel live. Their life is far more important than any history or biography that men write of me. And this is a brief thumbnail history of the great founder of our faith. And in it you see something which I believe to be unique in our Jewish way of life. Look through our long history. How many of our great leaders wrote biographies, autobiographies? How many of them set down on paper their accomplishments, their adventures? Very few. Our people sought to understand. They sought to describe the way of life which was proper. They lived in such a way as to serve, but they never separated, most of them avoided separating their needs, their wants, their desires from the service of their people and of their God. We're not a people that sets great store by personality. Man exists to serve. Serve his family, serve his community, serve his world, to serve his God. And that's his glory. And so we don't have to write the self-glorification. The autobiographies of which list our meager contributions to the history of man. And I wonder how many of us can serve this city or our people or our family without asking in each decision that we make, what's in it for me? How will it benefit my bank account? How will it benefit my prestige in the community? How will it benefit my family? Will it open doors for me? How rare are the man like Moses who serves because he must serve, because that is man's destiny, who does not seek to raise his family, to raise himself above the ordinary measure of humanity, who asks only the privilege of sharing the destiny of his people. And how rare this quality in a leader, a man of incomparable skill, a man of towering strength, a man whose accomplishments rank second to very few. There's a lesson in the biography of this great founder of our faith.